Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on 2012, the new Roland Emmerich film about the end of the world. So joining me today are John Swansburg, Slate's culture editor. Hey, John.
Hey, good to be here.
And from DC, we have Dan Coyce. Hey, Dan.
Hey, how are you guys?
And Dan is a contributor on film to The Washington Post, to True Slant, and to the New York Magazine culture blog, Vulture. So Dan, thanks for joining us from DC.
My pleasure.
All right, so 2012, you guys. Let's start from the beginning, which is the end of the world, and try to get through a plot summary of this immense, sprawling epic of destruction. So the title. Let's start with the title, John. Why 2012?
Right. So my understanding is that the Mayans foresaw that the world would end in 2012. Although I thought that this movie was going to be more about that ancient Mayan prediction, it really dispenses with it very quickly. Like there's one or two people say, you know, the Mayans saw this coming and predicted that the world would end. But in fact, the world doesn't end because of some like weird Mayan hex or it doesn't really.
There's nothing occult about it, right?
No,
I mean, the Mayans happened to have predicted it because their calendar ended in the year 2012, and so conspiracy theorists have long assumed that that means it's the end of the world or something. But except for a vague shot of a background ziggurat, there's no Mayan hocus pocus at all.
Right. It's purely a geological and maybe cosmological result. I mean, the science is very baffling. Maybe we should try to describe it. I don't really pretend to understand it at all.
Right. I had assumed that this movie would begin with shots of half-clad ancient Mayans prophesying that someday John Cusack would have to dive in the ocean in an attempt to save his family from the end of the world.
But right,
like, that
kind
doesn't
of like Mel Gibson
happen.
Style Mayan mumbo jumbo.
Right, right.
So the science as it's described is that unexpectedly intense solar flares cause the neutrinos that are regularly sent into the Earth's core by solar activity to mutate into a new kind of nuclear particle that behaves like microwaves.
Oh my God, that is so well summarized.
Yeah, that's impressive.
I can't believe your grasp on the pseudoscience.
And therefore heats up the Earth's core, melting the crust and causing immense tectonic shift.
And the microwave thing, John and I were commenting afterwards, the microwave thing in a crazy way makes sense because for some reason the Earth's core is heated to boiling, but the Earth's crust remains the same. So you can just sort of be walking along in Santa Monica and suddenly a geyser of magma will shoot up in front of you.
Right. There's no indication other than the cracks that start forming everywhere that anything is amiss.
So it's sort of like a microwave oven making like the butter inside a chicken Kiev patty really, really hot, but the chicken remains just sort of room temperature. So the first shot that we get in the movie, besides the solar flares bursting off the surface of the sun, is of Chiwetel Ejiofor, whose pronunciation of his name I just had to look up online, the British-Nigerian actor, sitting in the back of a cab reading Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy. I scribbled that title down because I thought, this is an odd detail that we're seeing this geologist, this crack geologist reading this piece of medieval philosophy, but it ends up being sort of perfect for his character and great for the movie. So Chiwetel is on his way to visit his geologist or something geophysicist friend in India who is for some reason the only person who knows about this mutant microwave phenomenon that's about to take place.
Right. He seems to basically have not only like a 10,000 foot deep copper mine, but also a particle accelerator in order to, or like some kind of camera to allow him to take shots of neutrinos in action. And he alerts Chiwetel Ejiofor of the upcoming danger. And then we're then treated to a great scene of Chiwetel in Washington telling Oliver Platt, who plays some kind of White House official. Is it ever made exactly clear?
We were saying chief of staff, maybe?
Or national security advisor, maybe?
Right. Or chief science officer, or maybe vice president. Who knows? It's never really made clear. But he somehow, at a party...
Oh, it can't be the vice president, because we'll get to the chain of command scene later.
Oh, right. That's right. So not the vice president, but some kind of high-level advisor. And he shows him a sheaf of papers at a black tie party, and it has one of those great scenes that you always get in movies like this, where Oliver Platt is, you know, first he's like, what is this, a geology crisis? And then he reads the papers, and in like 10 seconds flat, his face changes to dead serious, and he says, are you ready to meet the president? And then they like go off to meet the president.
Right. We should say that this is all taking place in 2010, if I'm not mistaken. That the movie starts 2 years before the eponymous year. And that's important because the idea is that after the Chiwetel character figures this out and alerts the higher echelons of the U.S. government, there is a plan put in motion to in reaction to the fact that we now know the world is essentially has a sell-by date of 2 years from now.
Right, and this is sort of the first way in which this movie diverges substantially from like the Roland Emmerich and Roland and quasi Roland Emmerich disaster plot, which is that in most cases, like in Independence Day or in especially in The Day After Tomorrow, there's long scenes of like scientists or crackpots or whoever desperately trying to make the people in charge understand the danger that they're in and then being dismissed and no one ever knowing what's going to happen until it's too late. But in this movie, everyone just believes Chiwetel Ejiofor and they enact a plan right away to save humanity, or at least the portion of humanity that can afford to pay $1 billion each for tickets on escape ships.
Right. And so they build these, I don't know how many spaceships, like 8 or 9 spaceships?
I think there are 8, yeah.
That are gonna-
well, we're led to believe that there's spaceships throughout. But one of the spoilers that we'll reveal, and bear in mind, listeners, that we're going to be spoiling this movie, one of the things that happens toward the end of the movie is that we discover belatedly that what we'd assumed to be spaceships all the way through are in fact arcs, literal arcs, enormous steel-plated ships meant to sail rough seas.
But they are actually spaceships as well, aren't they? Or were they on the water that whole time? I pictured them hovering above the Earth somewhere.
No, they're definitely just they're just nautical
vessels. Oh, wow, I missed a major plot point. I mean, when they say they're not spaceships, they're arcs, I thought that that was the symbolic function of the arc that was being stressed there because they had zebras and giraffes in them and stuff.
No, they're literal arcs, as in they're meant to float above the water. That was one of my favorite twists in this movie, that what I believe to be like every world-ending story, you know, that humanity would set off in spaceships to some distant land, was in fact just basically a retelling of, you know, the Noah story, except with a lot more people and a lot more action.
But why not just sell them to people?
Yes.
Why not just sell them to people who were buying the $1 billion tickets as arcs then? I mean, why say they're going to float above the Earth when they weren't going to float above the Earth?
I think that misinformation came from Woody Harrelson, that they were spaceships. I think that the people who were buying tickets understood them to be arcs, that essentially the globe would be covered entirely by water after this cataclysm, and so that they needed to be able to float until the waters receded and land, you know, at the end the Cape of Good Hope starts to reappear and they can sail for the land and start civilization over.
So let's catch our listeners up a little bit. So Woody Harrelson plays a crackpot radio host who is one of the few people not in the inner circle of government and bazillionaires to understand what's about to happen. And he tells John Cusack, who plays a down-on-his-luck novelist turned limo driver, everything he knows one weekend in Yellowstone, where John Cusack has gone with his children, whom he's taken for a weekend in Yellowstone. John Cusack doesn't believe him at first, but when shit starts hitting the fan, he puts two and two together. One of those twos is Woody Harrelson's prophecies, and the other two is the fact that his Russian oligarch boss is leaving on a plane really, really fast, and his kids say, "We're going on a ship and you're going to die." And John Cusack figures out this is what's happening. Something's going on. The world is going to collapse. He grabs his estranged wife. He grabs her new husband, a plastic surgeon played by Tom McCarthy. The wife is played by Amanda Peet, and he grabs his two kids and they take off on a globe spanning adventure, mostly involving, planes that take off from runways mere seconds before the entire runway crumbles.
And we shouldn't forget also the plot thread in which Danny Glover is the president in this kind of Obamian nod. John and I were saying that there's a black president, and there's also the future is going to end up being in Africa, right? They end up starting the new world in Africa. And so at some point in the movie, Danny Glover is essentially crushed by the
John F. Kennedy, which is an aircraft carrier. I mean, Emmerich has famously blown up the White House before, so he had to come up with some way of taking out that structure in a new way. And I thought this one was pretty novel. I guess there, as a result of the tectonic shifting, there's these massive tsunamis. So this huge wave just emerges. I don't know why the USS JFK was like hanging out outside of, you know, the Potomac.
It's in Chesapeake Bay. It's docked in Chesapeake Bay.
Oh, is it?
Ah.
Oh,
yes.
There you go. Verisimilitude.
That makes sense.
Go.
Yep.
Not a thing about this movie is outlandish or implausible.
Yes, it's verisimilitude is very impressive. So anyway, yeah, so that comes hurtling towards Pennsylvania Avenue and takes out Danny Glover with it.
Well, you know, it's funny you guys joke about the verisimilitude of this movie, but one of the great pleasures of it is that on its own ridiculous, skewed, pseudoscientific terms, it does have a great deal of integrity to its crackpot premise, which is to say, if you were to believe that such a ridiculous thing would happen, in fact, Yellowstone National Park would blow up into a super volcano with an explosion the size of like 20 megaton nuclear bombs.
Right. And California would basically split off from the rest of the U.S. before any other part.
And slide into the sea, and tidal waves would drench the Himalayas. And, you know, and so one of the things that I so enjoy about movies like this is a total commitment to the pseudoscience behind it. And this movie shows that like almost no other. I mean, to the point of constantly showing scientists for being forced to revise and re-revise their time estimates based on new data, and like long scenes of people anxiously awaiting calculations coming out of a computer. And, you know, I eat that stuff up.
That is a good point. It is funny how often our scientist hero is wrong about what he's predicting.
You mean Chiwetel?
Chiwetel, yeah. I mean, he was predicting, you know, when exactly the water is going to reach the arcs, and he's made a basic error in his calculations at one point. And I think there are a couple other times where he has gotten information wrong. That is a kind of a nice the idea that he would have somehow known the exact second that this was going to happen does seem, you know, a level of implausibility that the movie doesn't want, and that's kind of a nice thing. Although I would also say that while the movie does make some nice nods at trying to be realistic or sticking to its ridiculousness in a nice coherent way, there's also a sense in which our heroes are always escaping just ahead of cataclysm. That is, you know, I mean, it's what you expect in a movie like this, but it starts to strain credulity even within the context of this movie. I mean, the number of times that they, like, as you said before, take off a plane right before the runway disappears, or they drive their car, you know, between two falling buildings right before they crash, it starts to get a little silly.
Well, and the body count around them is getting to be so absurd. I mean, it's just literally at some moments people are falling like lemmings off of cliffs, basically.
Right.
And just hurling themselves into voids, and yet John Cusack, for no apparent reason, he's not a particularly impressive physical specimen, or, you know, there's nothing about him that would lead us to believe that, you know, somehow he would have this magical driving ability.
Right.
But the movie forces you to believe it. But
I like to imagine that everywhere in the world there were people who were following similar paths to John Cusack and his family that would possibly take them to those arcs in safety, but somewhere along the way they made a misstep and like their second plane took off 3 seconds late and they died, or they didn't drive past the donut, they got crushed by the donut and they died. Like John Cusack
just
happens to be the one who just happened to have everything go right, and that's the one family out of, you know, 20 zillion on Earth who actually made it to China. All the other non-rich families died.
Well,
I
want to get to the movie's vague stabs at having a social conscience, the gleeful way that it abandons them all, but I think we should take a break for a word from our sponsor first. So as regular listeners know, Slate has a deal with Audible.com, the leading provider of audiobooks on the web, where if you sign up for their service through our website, which is www.audiblepodcast.com/spoiler, you'll get a free audiobook along with your membership, and you can hang on to that audiobook even if you decide not to remain a member. But I think that you will remain a member because they have fabulous things like, John, let me throw it to you for the recommendation.
Sure. So the recommendation for today we thought was an apt one. We are recommending T.S. Eliot reading his own poem, The Wasteland, which is a pretty apocalyptic poem. And if you've never heard Eliot read it himself, you are really in for a treat. He has a sort of wonderful way of intoning the poem and occasionally singing little ditties that are threaded throughout the poem. And we think that it's a good pairing with this movie about the end of the world.
Yeah, because of the general apocalyptic tone. And he's just, I think, one of the great readers of his own poetry.
Yeah, you really understand this poem in a different way after you've heard him read it.
Let's listen to a little clip of it right now.
April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us, coming over the Starnberger See with a shower of rain. We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour.
Okay, so let's pick up, as promised, with this question of the ethical universe of 2012. The movie has this kind of vague attempt to to have a sort of socioeconomic critique of capitalism or something, where the Russian billionaire and a lot of other fancy people that are shown clutching their golden bags and things like that are the people that have managed to purchase their tickets and are trying to crowd their way onto these arcs, right? So basically, right. The idea is you can buy your own survival.
Or the argument is made by Oliver Platt's character, who's sort of like the ruthless pragmatist of the story, that the only way that such a project could be done in secret in the 1.5 years they had to accomplish it was to sell shares, basically, in advance. And so those billion-dollar tickets that thousands and thousands of rich people purchased are what caused the human race to survive at all.
Right.
Which is, I think, patently ridiculous. But the top 47 governments in the world couldn't come up with the money. I mean, if you know the world's ending in 2 years, can't you just print a lot of money and not worry about inflation?
Right.
No one's going to care, you know, when the ties rise.
Right.
Whether you've got too much currency out there.
Right. Or whether your budget deficit is too high. Like, who cares? The budget deficit gets erased. It's great.
Yeah, exactly.
I like the idea of the secret email mailings that went out to all the world's richest people saying, don't tell anyone, but the world's going to end.
Right.
And it's like the Nigerian king, right? Yeah, telling seriously. You to send money to his bank.
I like the idea that they've just formed a Yahoo group.
Yeah, but a lot of passcodes to get into that one.
But
that's all sort of left. Then there's a sort of a populist strain running through the movie as well, where people are suggesting, I forget if it's Thandie Newton's character who plays the daughter of the president, Danny Glover, who proposes a lottery. Why don't we have a lottery to see who can get on the ships? But that never happens. But at some moments, I guess there must be a lot of Cusack types who are just regular Joes who found out about this, because there's all these people trying to press their way onto these arcs that are docked in the Himalayas.
Well, except for the idea is that one of the arcs was damaged. And so there's this great... You know, there's this great speech that Chiwetel Ejiofor gives toward the end of it, where thousands of people are stuck on the docks as the tidal wave approaches, and Chiwetel gets everyone to agree to open the gates for these poor huddled masses who are left over. But those poor huddled masses are just leftover billionaires. There are billionaires who couldn't get on Arc 3 because it was damaged. And so I love the idea that what is once a populist strain in the movie just becomes the argument that we should, if there are a bunch of billionaires who might die, we guess we should save them too.
All billionaires are created equal.
Right.
Well, there are some Chinese workers thrown in there too. So I also like the idea of the people who survived are billionaires, a couple geologists, some random Chinese welders.
Right.
And
the Queen Elizabeth.
Queen Elizabeth, right. And her two dogs.
Right.
Well, there's a lot of chance, too, for these great actors to be paraded through for just a few seconds who vaguely resemble world leaders, and I love it. I love how the Russian premier kind of looks like Leonid Brezhnev with black, beetly brows, and
yeah,
the German
a great
woman
Merkel
is kind of Angela
Merkel-esque.
Yeah.
There's a fake Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, the fake Schwarzenegger fooled me at first. Yeah. I actually thought it was him.
It was the kind of thing you could see him doing in a cameo role like that, right?
But then he would never do the part where it is revealed that he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right. But we should also, I guess we alluded to this earlier, but we should make clear that in addition to allowing billionaires to get on the arcs, there's also an effort to preserve some species of animals.
Oh, yes.
This is my favorite, single favorite scene. Cusack and company sort of almost made it to the place where the arcs are being built, and they kind of come over a hill, and they can see where the arcs are. And then all of a sudden they look up in the sky and there are a bunch of sort of Chinook military style helicopters that have suspended from the bottom of the helicopters are all of these rare animals like giraffe. I guess they're not rare, but it's weird animals like giraffes and a hippopotamus or a rhinoceros. And you kind of get this idea that they're going to try to, you know, put all of these animals on the ark, sort of Noah's Ark style. But I just found it very amusing that space is obviously at a premium. There are very few humans that are going to survive, and yet someone thought that it'd be really important for the world to have giraffes.
Right. God's most useless animal.
Right. It's like, why not cattle, maybe some poultry? But giraffes and rhinoceroses, they take up a lot of space.
Also, so clearly the airlifted animals, it's just totally glorious. And then the giraffe figures in later, if you remember, when the Tibetan, we haven't even gotten into the Tibetan monk and his scientist brother, who are also become part of this final non-billionaire group who manages to press their way onto the Ark and survive. But the moment where the Chinese guy looks up as he's about to, I don't know, be crushed by the gears of the hydraulic gears of the ship, and he's inspired because above the grating, he sees the giraffe, the world's last giraffe standing there. Right. As I was saying to John, any movie where you can say, oh yeah, the scene where the Tibetan monk looks up through the grating and sees the world's only surviving giraffe, that's not a bad movie. Yeah.
Well, I also love that sometime, somewhere soon, some zookeeper is going to write an outraged op-ed about how in real life you cannot transport animals like that. And they would most almost certainly die from the shock.
You mean you can't custom sew a jacket for a giraffe with which you would suspend him from a Chinook helicopter?
And then fly him across the frigid Himalayas thousands of miles?
And also, like, I mean, maybe we can write it off as not having seen the entire animal operation, but, like, I saw one of everything.
Right.
Like, if there's only one giraffe, that's only going to be, you know...
Cloning, my friend, in 2012. Right. Cloning will have made some huge strides.
Right. Great point.
Well, so as long as John got to mention the airlifted animals, I have to mention my favorite running joke in the movie, which is the thing that had me and John literally crying in the subway ride on the way home from laughter, which is this ongoing theme of the Chiwetel Ejiofor character's great passion for John Cusack's novel, which we see a little stack of at the beginning in John Cusack's apartment. Apparently, he sold less than 500 copies of this book, which John was saying they could at least get some kind of literary consultant for the movie to tell them that that's such a low amount of copies that it's beneath plausibility. But at any rate, this
so many first-time novelists would disagree with you, John.
Really, that feels like an academic like manuscript number.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe it's just his book scan number and does not reflect chain store sales.
I mean, to me, his book felt like a self-published opus when you see it lying there. It's called Atlantis Forever. We don't know anything about it except it's a novel called Atlantis Forever that seems to have some vaguely end-of-the-world theme, which is why John Cusack is kind of interested and obsessed with these questions.
It has to do with a space shuttle on which I believe like the last humans alive are sent off into space, and it's described as like naively optimistic about what the good that people can do under dire circumstances. So
it's more prophetic than I had.
It is. Well, and so in a lot of ways, what I loved so much about the fact that Chiwetel Ejiofor keeps reading from this book and quoting John Cusack at one point in an inspiring speech and then reading it aloud to Thandie Newton while they're sitting on the ark. What I loved about it the most is that it sort of seems like the novelistic equivalent of a Roland Emmerich movie. Like it's an apocalyptic, sort of junky book, with literary pretensions about the end of the world and the good that people can do if they all work together. And the fact that Chiwetel Ejiofor chooses it among the books he wants to save from all of human civilization.
Oh, yeah. You see it with, like, The Great Gatsby.
Right, and The Odyssey.
His backpack.
And it just gave me such... It tickled me so much to think that Roland Emmerich was, like, trying to slyly make his case that junk art should be preserved, too, in case humanity is ever going to die. Like, not just the Mona Lisa and giraffes. Like, bad art should be preserved as well. And short of showing people actually loading film canisters of Independence Day onto the Ark, this is the best he could do to make that point.
All I can say is I could not wait for every new Chiwetel Ejiofor scene to see how he was going to drop some kind of reference to the book into the scene, no matter how dire the circumstances.
Right.
Yeah.
Right down to the moment when, as John Cusack is trying to pull this wrench out of the hydraulic gears, that's the only thing that's keeping the spaceship or the Ark from taking off, this single wrench that's fallen in, and he's about to drown doing it, and it's sort of the ultimate high-stakes climax of the movie, and you hear Chiwetel Ejiofor yelling through this closed vault door, "It's so-and-so, whatever his character name is. We met at Yellowstone."
I liked your book. Well, to his credit, and to the script's credit, John Cusack's response is, "That's great. Get us the hell out of here."
All right. So on the notion that bad art should maybe survive forever, let's just end on, I mean, what I think is a pretty round endorsement of this movie. No, aren't we all pretty much able to say that even though this is in almost every way indefensibly bad art, that everyone should go see it?
Yeah, it's really fun.
Yes. I mean, I I'm reviewing it for the Post and I debated with myself a lot about what I should do about this movie, because there are a lot of things about this movie that are just flat out wrong, that are ridiculous or outrageous or, morally reprehensible. But at the same time, the process of watching this movie was probably the most enjoyable 2.5 hours I've had in a movie theater in as long as I can remember. And I was never once unhappy to be there, and I was never once bored or upset or annoyed. Well, I was annoyed, but happily annoyed. And so in the end, I gave this movie 4 stars on the Washington Post.
Which is as many as you can get.
Which is as many as you can get in the Washington Post. And I'm excited to see what kind of response it will get. But I guess in the end, I felt like I could not separate or differentiate or lessen the pleasure that I got out of this movie as compared to the pleasure I get out of a great work of art, a great art film. And so though there is absolutely nothing artful about this movie at all, no matter how amazing the special effects are or how hilarious the performances are, it's such a efficient and amazing deliverer of pure pleasure that I just simply could not do anything but give it 4 stars.
I think that's defensible. Yeah. I mean, at the screening that Dan and I went to, I mean, people were rolling in their seats.
Yes.
I mean, people, it wasn't just like, you know,
snickering.
The two snooty,
it wasn't like snarky
slate writers.
No.
Yeah, like everybody in a big theater in Times Square was just having a grand old time.
Yes.
I mean, sure, like if Roland Emmerich was sitting there, I don't know how happy he would have been because we were really laughing at things that we weren't meant to laugh at, but whatever. I mean, it was totally fun, and a lot of people were having fun.
I think based on interviews with Roland Emmerich I've seen, I think that he does intend for us to laugh at these things, and this touches on something that you, I think, wanted to address, Dana, which is how, you know, is Roland Emmerich like a Paul Verhoeven? Is he just a maker of amazing high camp? And does he know that? And I think based on interviews with him, I think he does. I think he embraces that.
Yeah, I haven't read interviews about this specific movie, but I think just based on the movie itself, I would have to say that. I just don't think that ultimately it doesn't really matter whether we're laughing at or with the movie. It's just a really, really fun movie to see. But I think he's sort of reaching for that right now. I think maybe back in Independence Day, he was trying to style himself as the great epic director. But it seems to me like he's just content now to bring joy and destruction to all who
right. Well, and that's the great advantage of this movie over, say, Independence Day or The Day After Tomorrow, which are both movies in which I unironically enjoyed the first half and then was bored and shifty and annoyed through the second half. But with this movie, Roland Emmerich has finally realized, like, oh, we don't need to see Jake Gyllenhaal fighting off wolves or humans realizing that alien ships can be infected with Macintosh viruses. Like, all we really need is to just see the Earth exploding for 2.5 hours, and that's what we get. And it made me so happy that he finally gave me what I wanted out of his movies.
All right, well, Dan and John, this has been a delightful spoiler for a delightful movie. Thank you so much for joining me for this late spoiler special.
Thanks a lot, Dana.
For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.